content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is The Case for a Four-Day Workweek in Maryland by Carolyn Mims Nice. This is from February 2023. The Maryland State Capitol building is older than America. It is the only state capitol to have also served as the nation's capital. In the country's earliest days, Congress met in its chambers. To work in Annapolis is to operate in the shadow of history. So maybe that explains why, 246 years into the American project, one state lawmaker sees his four-day workweek bill as carrying on in the tradition of the ideals of the Declaration of Independence. That, or it's just a good hook. The framers put in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Vaughn Stewart, one of the bill's co-sponsors, told me, emphasizing that last one. This is really a larger conversation about where we are as a country and whether we need to ask ourselves, for the first time in almost a century, if there is something better than living to work. The very buzzy but actually kind of modest bill would create what is effectively a five-year experiment with a four-day workweek, creating $750,000 in tax credits for Maryland businesses per year over 5 years in exchange for them shortening their hours and handing over data to the state on how it goes. Stewart is a hardcore believer in the four-day workweek as the future. When I got on the phone with him, we spoke about the bill, work's place in American life, and how surviving cancer shifted his perspective. Our conversation has been condensed and edited for clarity. Carolyn Mims Nice, give me the elevator pitch for this bill. Why should it get passed? Vaughn Stewart, there has been an explosion of studies in the past year or two about the idea of companies reducing work hours, and the results of those studies have been, in my view, stunning. The employees loved working fewer hours, but what was really surprising is that the companies themselves reported greater productivity and ultimately greater profits. At the same time, the companies outside of the context of an experiment are also choosing to make this shift. So the elevator pitch is, given the obvious success of reducing work hours that we're seeing in businesses across the country and across the world, it only stands to reason that Maryland should try this out. Nice. Do you think Maryland is a particularly good candidate for this? Stewart. Yes, I think so. One of Maryland's nicknames is actually America in miniature. This idea has been studied in the United States to some extent, but has been studied much more heavily in Europe. The point of the bill is to get data that's more local and more relevant to us. You can make the case that Maryland, because it has so many different slices to it and so many different parts and so many distinct cultures and economies, is more representative of the entire United States than most other states. Nice. And why solve this in the public sector? If the incentives are there, why not let the private sector figure it out and move that way naturally? Stewart. That's what's happening to some extent, but two things. One, I think having the public sector get involved serves as a gentle nudge in this direction. Inertia is a powerful force. Second, it's not so much that the public sector is getting involved in private businesses as it is that we're paying companies using tax credits to collect data for us and share the data. At the end of the five-year pilot project, we'll have this trove of data that we can use to gauge whether this was successful. There have been four-day workweek bills in the U.S. House and in California that essentially required companies to pay overtime after 32 hours. That's a really clean and also free way for the government to go about this. But it's also extremely heavy-handed. I think the reason those bills haven't gone anywhere is that companies come out in full force to rail against government intervention in the marketplace. What's unique and new about this approach that we're trying in Maryland is that we're not forcing any companies to do anything they don't want to do. Rather than going to the hearing for the bill with every industry group cursing my name, hopefully I can go to the bill hearing with all of them standing beside me. Nice. We're talking a lot about the practical politics of this. How much of a philosophical believer in the four-day work week are you? Stuart, I'm a believer. I definitely think that we need more Maryland-specific data if we're going to make any future steps or commit any more money to it. But ultimately, I'm not a neutral observer. I'm not a social scientist. I'm an advocate for this. We need to make forward progress if we want to convince people, workers, other policymakers, business owners, that this is the way forward. We need more study results that are specific to relevant communities. It's going to be really hard to persuade my colleagues that the time is now for this idea if the only data we have comes from Scotland. That's just not going to be as persuasive as if it comes from Scotland, Maryland, and Berlin, Maryland, and Cambridge, Maryland. I'm not at all a dispassionate observer of this. I very much think that this is the way of the future. This is the original American dream. The thought that was always that we were going to continue to be more and more productive and work less and less. But at a certain point, we stalled out. It was extremely radical when Henry Ford moved to a five-day work week. People were shocked. People even called it anti-biblical because the Bible said there was only one rest day. The labor movement took this as their cause célèbre, and over a grinding series of decades, they were able to force states and the federal government to institute a five-day work week as a matter of law. But it's been 100 years. Somewhere in the 80s or 90s, we sort of got off track. Nice. So you're really viewing this in the long arc of American labor history. Do you ever have any personal doubts? Stuart, I do think that there's one big question mark with this idea, which is, how do we make sure that the effects reverberate across the economic spectrum? Because right now, with the exception of maybe some hospitals cutting hours for nurses, the companies that have made this step so far are Kickstarter, Shake Shack, Shopify. Typically, white-collar employees are the ones benefiting from more flexible schedules and reduced schedules. Just like how in the pandemic, white-collar employees benefited from more flexible time and flexibility to come into the office, whereas blue-collar workers didn't get that break. They still had to go in every day and punch a clock, even if it meant they were going to expose themselves to getting sick. The tricky thing here is that it's a difference between salaried workers and hourly workers, and we've got to figure out a way to make sure that this bill, or this movement, doesn't become something that is felt most viscerally by people that already are doing pretty well. We want to make sure that this is an economy-wide transformation, and if it helps any group in particular, it helps those who are working class the most, because they're the ones who have borne the weight of America's overworked culture for the past several decades. Nice. Are there any criticisms of the bill that you just flat out don't agree with? Stuart. Probably the criticism that is valid, but that I just don't agree with, is the sort of quasi-libertarian idea that the state of Maryland just shouldn't care about this, that we shouldn't meddle in the affairs of private businesses. There's nothing more fundamentally connected to a Marylander's quality of life than how much free time they have. So the idea that that would not be in the purview of policymakers to me is insane. Nice. Why do you think that is? Stuart, the bill is connected with the idea of improving the day-to-day lives of regular people. And I think for people who are ideologically committed to comforting the comfortable, it's an anathema that they would support something that cuts costs for companies, but through the lens of trying to make workers' lives a little bit more whole. Nice. Like your colleagues at the State House? Stuart, yeah. I have colleagues in the other party who applauded, for example, when President Donald Trump cut taxes for corporations. I have heard a couple of quotes in the media from some of my colleagues who seem like maybe they're going to oppose this on the grounds of laissez-faire capitalism. Let the markets work. But honestly, I haven't really heard that much pushback at all about this. There has been an explosion of interest in the bill. This is my fifth year in the General Assembly. This bill has attracted more attention from my colleagues, from interest groups, and from the media than every other bill I've ever put in has combined. Like 95% of the interest has been positive. Nice. We've talked through one philosophical criticism from libertarians about the role of the state. That's pretty much their whole gig. I wonder if there's a practical criticism here. Why is this something Maryland should spend money on versus all other issues that are facing the state at any given time? Stuart, that's a tough one. If the bill doesn't pass, I think that's what will doom it. Because even though we have a budget surplus in the state of Maryland, it certainly is the case that any time you want to spend money, you've got to compete with every other priority under the sun. And I'm sure some of those priorities are more pressing and more important than this bill. But this is only $750,000 of tax credits. This is not going to break the bank in the grand scheme of the state budget. And I would add that there's scarcely anything more important to humanity than free time. Nice. Well, like health, maybe, not dying of the coronavirus? Stuart, yeah, not dying. The framers put in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Certainly life is important. We want you all to be healthy. Liberties are important as well, obviously, and all the different freedoms we enjoy, and making sure that those hold true. But the pursuit of happiness is something that is also really important. This is really a larger conversation about where we are as a country, and whether we need to ask ourselves, for the first time in almost a century, if there is something better than living to work. America once stood for better ideals than just eternally increasing wealth and everlasting consumerism. The reason I get so fired up about this is I've actually had cancer twice. Nice. I'm sorry to hear that. Stuart, no, I appreciate it, and I'm all good now. It kind of puts it in perspective. All the different tropes and truisms and cliches about realizing that nobody's guaranteed tomorrow. I think when you have that experience at such a young age, you realize how important time is. Time is a gift. And so the idea that there would be a bill, but also a larger movement about reclaiming some of that time for ourselves, because it's finite for all of us, I think that has some real power for a lot of people. Whether they have gone through an illness or an accident or they've watched a parent or grandparent get older, I think people realize somewhere deep in their bones that their time is valuable, and they want to reclaim some of it for themselves. Our second article is from the Planet section of the February 2023 issue of The Atlantic. Bring on the boring EVs. The next step toward electric cars just becoming cars is playing out. This is an edited version of the story by Emma Maris. If you tune into Queer Eye next season, you may find the Fab Five talking about the transformative power of a carefully curated refresh. From the interior of a zero-emissions Hummer pickup truck. The placement is part of a new deal between Netflix and General Motors to feature electric vehicles on the streaming service, a deal that both companies are promoting as a step toward, quote, creating a better, more sustainable future for our world, end quote. But the idea that placing EVs in TV shows is leading-edge progressivism seems somewhat dated. EVs are just normal now. Lots of people drive them for lots of reasons, not just your colorful hippie aunt or your tech bro brother-in-law who will not shut up about his Tesla Model S. They are just cars. EVs accounted for 5.8% of the cars sold in the United States in 2022, up from just more than 3% the year before. In California, almost 18% of new cars sold are fully electric. In part thanks to the tax breaks and incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act, the price of EVs is also finally coming down to parity with the price of gasoline-powered cars. But incentives and competitive prices can only do so much. People have to want to buy the car. If we are to hit President Joe Biden's goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030, much of the country will need to switch to EVs. Making electric cars cool could help, but something even better is on the horizon from a mass adoption standpoint. We may be at the dawn of the boring EV. If we want to reduce emissions, electric vehicles have to be seen as the safe, normal, default option. And the cultural place of EVs and the hybrids that pave the way for them in American life can be tracked by examining how they show up on the screen. At least through the prism of pop culture, acceptance has moved through four major phases. 1. EVs as a signifier of the future. In keeping with its overall theme of cutting-edge technology, 1993's Jurassic Park featured Ford electric explorers that were powered through a track in the ground. Phase 2. EVs and hybrids as signifiers of earnest liberalism. After the first Prius came out in 1997, having a character drive a hybrid became an easy way to tell viewers something about their politics or personality. Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm drives a Prius. In season 2 of Weeds, which aired in 2006, soccer mom turned drug dealer Nancy swaps her Range Rover for a Prius, signifying a shift to a more environmentally conscious outlook. Phase 3. EVs as expensive toys. Tony Stark had a Tesla Roadster as far back as the first Iron Man movie in 2008. Love him or hate him, Elon Musk made EVs cool when they were trapped in Squaresville, and Tesla has become the brand du jour in hip-hop. The first trailer recently dropped for Fast X, the 10th installment in the street racing juggernaut. For the first time, the franchise will reportedly feature at least a couple of electric cars, such as the Dodge Daytona SRT EV concept car and the unreleased DeLorean Alpha 5. What's crucial about this era is that these cars being eco-friendly has become beside the point. They are simply flashy and cool. EVs have started becoming normalized, even if they are still out of the price range of the majority of viewers. That phase hasn't ended, but another phase is appearing alongside it. Phase 4. EVs as just a car, a normal vehicle. In the near future, EVs will be in film and on TV constantly, and they won't say anything in particular about the characters that drive them. This new phase is upon us because EVs are finally becoming ubiquitous. In some markets, they are the commonplace choice instead of cool statement pieces meant to stand out. You don't hear shout-outs to the Kia EV6 in rap lyrics, but you do see them lining up in affluent suburbs at school pickup. I don't know if they are normal, but they are undeniable, says James Pumphrey of Donut Media, a YouTube channel about cars and trucks with more than 7.3 million subscribers, mostly in their teens and 20s. According to Pumphrey, the Tesla Model 3 or Model Y has replaced the Audi A4 or the BMW 3 Series as the car that says, "Hey, I'm doing pretty well as a young professional." These days, you don't buy a Model 3 because it's wild and different. You buy it because it's a safe choice. If we are really entering an era in which electric cars are just cars, that will go a long way to speeding up EV adoption in the U.S. And apart from the quiet hum of the highway or the suddenly cleaner air, a world in which most of the cars on the road are not emitting planet-toasting fumes will also be one where it feels okay to love cars again. Making EVs boring might be necessary to make them the default choice, but once they've taken over, there will also be a whole smorgasbord of fun, fast, and interesting electric options that the gearhead can get jazzed about. On Donut Media, you can find a video about putting massive gas-guzzling V8 engines in Nissan 350Zs, but you can also find an 18-minute video ranking electric cars by how many seconds it takes them to get to 60 miles an hour. Several of them can apparently hit 60 in 2 seconds. If you are a car enthusiast who keeps up with new models, you sort of have to get excited about EVs. GM and the other automakers have announced plans to close or shrink their internal combustion engine development divisions in the coming divisions. Electrics are where the innovation is. There are caveats, of course. EVs have an environmental footprint. Their batteries, in particular, rely on minerals such as lithium and cobalt, which have been mined out of the ground. So there's still a good argument for reducing the number of cars on the planet, electric or otherwise. And any car will still be expensive, bulky, and a pain to maintain. The true autotopia will be the day when driving a car is 100% optional for those who would prefer not to own one, and 100% guilt-free for those who love them. For those people, there's a lot to love. Take the Porsche Taycan, an all-electric sports car that is fast, powerful, and objectively gorgeous. Pumphrey got to drive one, and he said the experience was nothing short of magical. At once familiar Porsche, but also new. It's like a new sound. It's like a new way that the power comes on. It's a new way of acceleration. It was a beautiful experience. He even got a little misty-eyed. I was like, oh man, I've never felt this. From the sensible commuter to the rugged off-roader to the silky smooth sports car, the era in which electric cars are just cars is not far off. EVs just need to get a little more boring. The day Americans stop noticing them on their screens is the day the electric car will have truly arrived. Today's third article is an opinion piece from the Ideas Department of the February issue, entitled America Has Gone Too Far in Legalizing Vice, by Matthew Loftus. The cause of gambling, a gambling problem, is the individual's inability to control the gambling. So says the National Council on Problem Gambling, an organization funded by the gambling industry to help people who have become addicted to its products. This attitude, that anyone who falls into gambling addiction has only themselves to blame, has allowed state lawmakers to ignore arguments that more access to gambling might make it easier for people to lose control. Since the Supreme Court struck down previous restrictions on sports betting in 2018, 36 states have legalized it, and new ballot initiatives are proposed every year. If you've watched a sporting event lately, you've been bombarded with ads for online sports gambling. Similarly, when marijuana legalization is debated, supporters emphasize how the responsible use of marijuana might alleviate the pain of those suffering from incurable diseases. They also point to the worst excesses of the war on drugs, which disproportionately affect black people. This argument has been successful. Only 4 states prohibit all uses of marijuana. In 19 states, the recreational use of marijuana is now fully legal. All other states allow medicinal use of cannabis products. When arguments are made for loosening the government's restrictions on vice, usually proponents make their case with idealistic situations. Shouldn't responsible, independent adults be able to make decisions for themselves about how they spend their money or use their body? This seems appealing, and there are certainly are well-informed adults who gamble and use marijuana judiciously. But focusing on these ideal cases and basing our laws on them disregards millions of people who suffer because of their addictions, and it obscures the underhanded tactics of companies who make money off the misery of addicts. These debates expose a conflict over what we believe about virtue and vice. If we think that human beings, especially young people who are forming the habits that will last a lifetime, tend to make decisions based on what they have reasoned to be their best interest, then legalization makes sense. If life is a series of contracts we enter into freely, then there's no reason to keep potential harms off of our smartphone or out of our storefront dispensaries. However, this way of seeing the world overlooks the fact that our hearts and minds are shaped not only by reason, but also by our experiences, affections, and most important, our habits, which are just as often inexplicably self-destructive as they are reasonable. A rise in access to legal gambling will inevitably lead to a rising in gambling addicts. State laws tend to allow the gambling industry to regulate itself, which means that these companies are expected to identify and exclude their steadiest customers. This has been as unsuccessful as one might expect. As much as 50% of revenue comes from problem gamblers, while one study showed that in 1998, only 4% of gambling revenue from video lottery games came from responsible gamers. Just as tobacco companies would go out of business if people used their products responsibly, gambling wouldn't be a multi-billion-dollar industry if it weren't for addicts. Marijuana has a more complicated legacy, especially because it has real but rather modest benefits for medicinal use. However, careful analyses show that marijuana legalization has contributed to a rise in opioid-related deaths, especially when dispensaries can legally sell all sorts of cannabis products. Permitting dispensaries also increases referrals for addiction treatment, which is unsurprising considering that higher potency products are more dangerous. The best evidence we have suggests that marijuana is harmful to teenage brains as they develop, and that more teenagers use marijuana when it is legalized in their state. The industries that profit off addiction want to frame the question of access around responsible use, and occasionally suggest that some people might have a genetic predisposition to addiction. This individualistic framing allows them to avoid talking about how much effort they're putting into making their products as accessible as possible. There's a richer and more compelling vision, one that is drawn from philosophical traditions across the ages. It recognizes that our life together isn't merely a series of contracts we negotiate, and that our ability to make good decisions isn't based simply on our rationality. Virtue is not simply doing good deeds, but also a set of dispositions and habits that must be practiced in order to flourish. Just as people can be sucked into addictions, we can also work to develop the virtues inside us so that we can be kind, generous, and self-controlled throughout our lives. Driven by this rich view of life together, we should make it as difficult as possible to access things that impair our ability to make good decisions. It's not the government's primary job to protect people from their own worst impulses, nor is the state the primary source of our virtue formation. But we do recognize that policy plays a role in shaping the environment so that we can develop our virtues. Just as highways have guardrails for the moments when a driver isn't exercising perfect self-control, so we need guardrails to help people from driving off cliffs of vice. People often point to the historical example of prohibition in America to prove that overregulation of vice carries its own dangers. While the classical tradition of virtue encourages moderation in all things, including moderate regulation and moderate prohibition, this tale is more complicated than the one that exists in the popular imagination. Domestic violence and alcohol-related illnesses were at record highs prior to the passage of the 18th Amendment, and prohibition was effective at reducing both. There's no evidence that organized crime increased in strength because of prohibition, merely that it became more visible. In any case, a century later, we can design our regulations around gambling and marijuana to protect the most vulnerable people, especially young people, while still allowing those who want to lose some money to do so with a little extra effort, and permitting those who could benefit from marijuana to do so under the supervision of a physician. Some judicious restrictions are better for everyone. We will need a lot more than a few regulations to help one another grow in virtue, but right now, vice and its lobbyists have an unfair advantage that needs to be taken away. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.